Well, happy Bloomsday, everyone. Yep, today, June 16th, 2004, marks the centenary of the date at which Ulysses by James Joyce was set, June 16th, 1904. 100 years ago today, of a book that was published, I think, 1932. Interesting factoid. And another interesting factoid, I don't know if there are any other basketball fans. I was very happy seeing the game last night, being from Michigan. So I was psyched. Welcome to this Chicago Media Action presentation, a public education forum series featuring Robert Jensen from the University of Texas at Austin. We usually have these presentations at the Chicago Temple, but we're having it here at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and we have some people to thank. One person in particular, Eric Peters, from the group Students for Social Justice, who helped as far as early organizing to ultimately secure this room, and we thank him and the group for their efforts. Also in particular, Steve Jones, the University of Illinois at Chicago in the Department of Communications, who helped with securing, also with other organizing efforts for securing this room. As far as the presentation for this evening, how it's going to work is we will have the presentation from Professor Jensen. This will be accompanied by excerpts of two films by the Media Education Foundation, which will feature Professor Jensen. The two films are Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land, and the second one called Hijacking Catastrophe. Professor Jensen will give his presentation, and then we'll open the floor up for questions, discussion, whatever. A couple of announcements just for media activists' sake of upcoming events. I take it, is everyone here familiar with what's happening this Friday at 10 a.m.? Maybe not. Yeah? Oh, you are. Okay. Yeah, CAN-TV, Chicago Access Network Television, the fleet of Chicago cable channels, is right now in a key battle to basically secure funding for the foreseeable future. And there's going to be a hearing regarding an ordinance. The hearing will be this Friday, 10 a.m. at City Hall, 121 North LaSalle, second floor. If you can come, please do so. If you also, if you go to the Chicago Media Action website, I've built a web page on the website, which, with typing in your name and your address and pushing a button, will actually send a fax to the mayor's office. CAN-TV tells us that right now it's crucial to notify the mayor to drum up support from the mayor in support of this ordinance. And so we've sent out in the last 4 days about 30 faxes through this form. And if you haven't done so, if you could take all of 30 seconds, it turns out, to use the form, we've made it very easy. ChicagoMediaAction.org is the website for that. And also, some good news. There's an initiative right before the Senate right now, in fact. On June 4th, John McCain had introduced before the Senate the Low Power Radio Act of 2004. This is an initiative which would deploy on a mass scale perhaps thousands of low power radio stations across the United States. A city the size of Chicago stands to get anywhere from maybe 10 to 25 low power radio stations, potentially. And these could be used for efforts and community and localism, helping to support localism in media, where a lot of the corporate media really don't provide that. So we encourage you to contact your senators here in Illinois, Dick Durbin and Peter Fitzgerald. There is apparently some support and motivation for this campaign, and so you can get involved with that. That's all as far as what I wanted to say. In a moment, I'll hand the floor over to Professor Jensen, and after I read this introduction. Robert Jensen joined the University of Texas faculty in 1992 after completing his PhD in Media Law and Ethics in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Prior to his academic career, he worked as a professional journalist for a decade. He teaches graduate and undergraduate courses in media law, ethics, and politics. Jensen also is director of the Senior Fellows Program, the honors program of the University of Texas College of Communication. In his research, Jensen draws on a variety of critical theories. Much of his work has focused on pornography and the radical feminist critique of sexuality. In more recent work, he has addressed questions of race through a critique of white privilege and institutionalized racism. In addition to teaching and research, Jensen writes for popular media, both alternatives and mainstream. His opinion and analytic pieces on such subjects as foreign policy, politics, and race have appeared in papers across the United States. He is also involved in a number of activist groups working against U.S. military and economic domination of the rest of the world. Jensen is author of a number of books, including Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, as well as Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream. And he is also co-author with Gail Dines and Anne Russo of Pornography, the Production and Consumption of Inequality, and co-editor with David S. Allen of Freeing the First Amendment, Critical Perspectives on Freedom of Expression. And this evening, Professor Jensen will give a presentation on taking action to reform media. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Robert Jensen.
Thank you all. Feels a little strange with a small group and all these microphones and all this reverb, but that's okay. And it's nice to be here with Chicago Media Action. We don't have such a group down in Austin, Texas, where I teach, so I might have to go down and spark some energy and activism down there on this subject. What I thought I would do is, in a sense, cover things that may be very obvious to all of you, but try to frame them in a way that might help us figure out how to talk to other activists, other people, and in fact, even to mainstream people about the importance of media reform, media activism. I think there's a lot of work to do to make it clear to people why paying attention to the media is so important. To steal a line from Robert McChesney, whose work is so important on critique of media, Bob has always said that if whatever your first issue is, whether it's the war, feminism, environmental work, whatever your first and sort of primary passion is politically, your second issue should be the media, he says, for the obvious reasons that in a large complex society like this, so much of the public does get the vast majority of its information through mainstream commercial corporate media. Therefore, that question becomes very salient for anybody who's trying to do progressive politics, dissident politics, politics that goes against the grain or the conventional wisdom. So I think it's very important for people who otherwise might not see media as something they care much about, and I run into folks like that in all sorts of political movements, to make it clear that they should care about it. Because if we don't get progress on the media front, in a sense, it's hard to imagine much progress on any of the various social, political, economic issues that people might be involved in and might want to see a more just and humane world. So I think it's very important to go into places where people might not be media savvy or focused on media politics to make that case. Well, the case I think we should make to people, that is how to think about a comprehensive media strategy, which is where I'll start, really I think has four legs to it. And I'm going to talk about two of them in much more detail today. But first of all, of course, there's the question of structural change. That is, we live in a media system that is overwhelmingly dominated by the corporate commercial media, what we tend to call, for shorthand often, the mainstream media. Even the public media that do exist in this country largely follow a corporate model, that is, PBS and NPR. And those groups are, in fact, more and more supported by what they call underwriting, what any other person would call advertising, as well as grants that tie them to that same corporate commercial system. So we have a media system that is overwhelmingly privatized, corporate and commercial, and therefore fundamentally unable to serve a democracy. In this sense, media systems are like biological systems. We would expect the healthiest systems are the most diverse systems, and this is a distinctly non-diverse system. So we can talk more in questions, if you like, about what that system might look like. For me, it would almost certainly involve a much more balanced mix of, if we are going to live in a capitalist and market system, certainly there would be a role for private media. There should be a role for much more expansively funded public media that is based in professional journalism, that is public radio and public television, that are serious. And then, of course, I think most of us would agree there should be considerably more funding and support for what we could call grassroots media, democratic media, local media, that is, ways to funnel real funding to local groups that can give voice to local interests and local communities. So that's the structural change that's going to have to happen. And I think there was a lot of hope in the reaction of the public to the FCC's attempt to further deregulate broadcasting last summer. Of course, you all know about that. But that was hopeful because it did bring out not simply a left progressive constituency, but a very broad-based constituency. That is, that tells us there is interest across the spectrum politically in the United States for that kind of structural change. And if you haven't looked at it, of course, I think the Free Press, the group that really led the charge on that FCC issue, has a website at mediareform.net that is a good sort of clearinghouse for information on that particular front in the media battle. The second part of a media strategy, a comprehensive media strategy, I think, should be working with mainstream media on the terrain as they define it. And this is something I think media or progressive political groups often overlook. That is, if you do that structural critique and you see the problems with the way the system is structured, there's often a tendency to then abandon any interaction with it, but I think that's a mistake. If, in fact, the majority of people in this country get the vast majority of their information from the mainstream media, then it's in the interests of progressive groups to do what they can to use that medium. And that's, in fact, what this other book of mine, Writing Dissent, is about. How do you understand how journalists work? And to the degree it is possible within the constraints they work under, how do you interact with them for a more balanced, fair, and one would hope, wide-ranging kind of political discourse? And there are ways to do that. There are ways to work with reporters and editors to help them shape stories that do take into account those alternative voices. The book Writing Dissent is mostly about how to use the op-ed pages, how to write in a way that can actually land some of your own ideas onto the opinion pages of very conventional newspapers. So I think that second sort of leg of the strategy of working with mainstream media, accepting the rules under which they work and trying to, in a sense, leverage as much as you can in that system is very important and often overlooked. The third and fourth components of the media strategy that I want to talk about are the ones I want to focus on tonight. One is the critique of media performance. That is, after one has gone through and looked at the structure and tried to figure out long-term political projects to change, diversify, and democratize the structure of media, but at the same time that one is still trying to work with media, there is also a role for critiquing the mainstream media. Here, probably the example people are most familiar with is Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which at the national level does exactly that. It monitors professional practices, it looks at the content of the news, and weighs in when possible, often by activating grassroots base, to try and critique and, one would hope, change media performance. So I think the most recent example of that was the apology or the editorial note that the New York Times ran, it was now about a month ago, some people were calling a mea culpa, others were calling a mini culpa. The minor way in which the New York Times acknowledged that it's reporting on the whole question of weapons of mass destruction in the run-up to the Iraq War was essentially fraudulent. That was in part the result of pressure from readers. And I think groups like FAIR had a lot to do with that. I'm going to talk tonight and show a clip from a documentary that critiques U.S. media coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict as an example of that. Let me say a few more words about that before we go on to that clip. The reason that critique of the mainstream media in this way is important is, I think, twofold. One is that you are trying always to communicate directly to the journalists, to let them know that people are monitoring them and that there are expectations that they will meet their own professional ideals. That is, the work that FAIR does is often intended to say to journalists, listen, you have norms, ideals of fairness, accuracy, balance, and we feel you're not living up to them. So one intended audience for that media critique is always the journalists themselves. The second audience for that kind of critique is, I think, the general public. That is, understanding that you can have only limited effects on the practice of journalism in the short term. That is, no matter how well you orchestrate a campaign to critique the practice of journalists, journalists still work within those constraints. And that part of the other object of the critique of the mainstream media is to help educate the public so that they can become better critical readers and viewers of that material themselves. And I think the clip I want to show you from this video, I think, illustrates a very effective tool for educating the public. Let me say a few words about it before we take a look at it. This was, as Mitchell said, a documentary produced and distributed by the Media Education Foundation. If you're not aware of their work, I really recommend it. The Media Education Foundation was started more than a decade ago now by a communications professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, a man named Sut Jolly, who produced a very interesting video critiquing the gender images and sexuality images in MTV, the video called Dream Worlds, which he literally did, you know, homemade in his home in his office. And the success of that video led to now a nonprofit foundation that produces educational videos for use mostly in schools, but also for community groups, that looks at some of these crucial issues around both entertainment and journalistic media. So there are things about video games and also things about the performance of journalists. This one, I think, is probably one of their best films. It's, again, called Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land. And it looks at the fundamental question of why coverage in the United States of the Israel-Palestine conflict looks the way it does, which I would argue, as the video does, radically skewed to endorse an Israeli view of the conflict. It's an interesting film made by a woman who was born and raised in Israel, an Israeli Jew who came to the US to go to school and stayed and is currently one of the producers at MEF. And in addition to the critique of the media coverage, I think it also does an extremely good job of simply explaining the occupation and the contemporary question in Palestine very effectively. So in a sense, it has both a function as a media critique, and it also is its own alternative media, in a sense, educating. We'll talk more about that function later. But what I'd like to do is play a clip from the first segment of it, which talks about the way in which the Israeli government has really targeted the American media. And the documentary goes on to explain, of course, the importance of that because American public opinion is so crucial in the Israel-Palestine conflict, because without the support of the United States government, the Israelis could not successfully continue that occupation. So this is one segment from it. And we'll take a look at it and then come back and talk about some more parts of this media strategy.
CBS Evening News.
Americans rely on the news media for information about events occurring around the world. News, especially television news, exerts a powerful influence on our perceptions, telling us which events are important and shaping our understanding of the issues. Given the central role played by the United States in the Middle East conflict, and thus the vital role played by American voters, influencing U.S. media coverage of the conflict is crucial. Controlling the images and words used to explain the conflict has become an important extension of the struggle.
Israel is really fighting a war on two fronts. The first is a military campaign being waged in the occupied territories against the Palestinian people. And the second is a PR campaign being waged here in the US through the American media to ensure continued support for Israel's occupation. Alon Pincus, Consul General for Israel in New York and the coordinator of Israel's PR efforts, was recently quoted as saying, "We are currently in a conflict with the Palestinians, and engaging in a successful PR campaign is part of winning the conflict." So you could say that in addition to the military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, Israel is also involved in an attempt to ideologically occupy the American media.
The roots of Israel's public relations campaign go back to the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon that earned it worldwide criticism, in particular the massacre of Palestinian civilians at the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. To the Israeli government, the problem was not the deaths of thousands of civilians. Rather, it was the damage to Israel's public image, a public relations disaster in need of damage control.
They surrounded Beirut. In 3 months, 17,500 people, almost all of them civilians, were killed. I saw many thousands of their bodies. Then came the massacre of Sabra and Shatila by Israel's own allies as the camp was surrounded by Israeli troops. And they desperately said, what went wrong? It was concluded that the problem was there wasn't good enough public relations.
After the public relations disaster of Lebanon, Israel decided to set up permanent institutional structures to control how Americans would think about the Middle East. In 1983, Israel launched the Hasbara Project, the aim of which was to ensure good press in the U.S. media. The goal was to train Israeli diplomats in communications and public relations. For example, they trained press officers in Israeli consulates in the U.S. to ensure that American journalists would write stories favorable to Israel. As one of these press officers said in the 1980s, he had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with journalists, and that a typical day would involve conversations with producers at leading news and TV talk shows about the content of the program. He described it as, in fact, quote, a joint formulation of ideas. This targeting of the American media goes on in the present day.
The Israeli press office is spitting out press releases, statements, information all the time. So you could sit in a bureau in Jerusalem and file stories from there all the time without really having to have much imagination or have much energy or have much drive. Palestine Authority press office is almost useless, and they certainly aren't providing you with ready-made stories the way the Israeli press office is.
Because of lack of access to Palestinian officials in the West Bank and the sophistication of Israel's PR techniques inside Israel, a lot of times the stories are already tilted in Israel's favor before they ever leave American journalists sitting in the area.
When you're talking about how the story is covered from the U.S., the propaganda machine is even more effective than it is in Israel.
American news coverage is influenced by a complex set of institutional relationships. These influences can be thought of as a series of filters through which the news must travel before it emerges in the voices of news anchors. To understand how American news media report on the Middle East conflict, we need to understand how these institutional filters operate. Among the most important of these filters are the business interests of the corporations that own the mass media, interests that extend beyond the United States and across the globe to the Middle East. The economic interests of media owners are shared by political elites, politicians, and policymakers who form a second filter. These political elites have the power to access and influence mainstream media and are themselves part of a system dominated by corporate money and interests. The strategic importance of the Middle East to these two groups is reflected in media coverage of the region and of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A third filter, Israel's own public relations efforts, further affects the coverage. The government of Israel employs some of the largest American public relations firms as image consultants to coordinate its political and media campaigns. Nine Israeli consulates help implement these PR campaigns by developing relationships with journalists and monitoring media outlets. Scores of private American organizations, both Christian and Jewish, reiterate the official line, and organize grassroots opposition to any coverage deemed unfavorable to Israel. The most important of these is AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, widely regarded as the most powerful foreign lobby in Washington. This institutional framework of American business and political interests in combination with Israeli public relations shapes media coverage of the Middle East. At the same time, those progressive organizations opposing Israeli government policy, such as Jews Against the Occupation and Americans for Peace Now, rarely make it through these filters. Finally, if any news stories critical of Israeli policy do surface, there are a host of media watchdog groups that monitor and pressure journalists and media outlets, the most important of which is CAMRA.
You have activist organizations from the right, the pro-Israeli right, that very effectively, they say monitor, I would say harass journalists and their editors and try to make sure that the coverage is objective, by which they mean pro-Israel.
You can see all of the, you know, kind of pressure groups to, you know, write campaigns of letters to the editor against, you know, news outlets and ask for, you know, demand that stories be changed or that, you know, that reporters be fired.
The abuse against a journalist is something you just have to take into account. If you, you know, both literally and metaphorically, if you work in the Middle East, you've got to take the sticks and stones. What I object to is that my American colleagues don't seem to be prepared to do that.
And even in Israel itself, you know, you can find the main daily newspapers, like Haaretz, for example, provides coverage on the ground and analysis, some of which has views on the conflict that would be almost beyond pale for an American journalist, say at the New York Times, to write.
The main major television news networks and newspapers in the United States have long ago got their fear to be supreme over their duties as journalists. They are not monitoring the centers of power when it comes to the relationship between America and the Middle East, Israel and America, and America and the Arabs and the Palestinians. They will not ask the right questions, they will not report it using the correct words, they will not confront the reality, and they've given up. And I think once you acquire fear, it's very difficult to get rid of it.
Yeah. Lights.
All right. That gives you, I think, a little flavor of that particular video. The director producer, Bathsheba Ratzkoff, really, I think, did a phenomenal job. It's about an 80-minute video, and it, again, not only helps one understand how the media operate, but how the whole issue sort of plays out these days. We screened it recently in Austin and had the director in, and I can't tell you how many people, we have an audience of 200, their main reaction was, oh, now I get it, now I understand. It was that sort of kind of recognition. And I think that says a lot about how much education there is to do in the public around these kinds of media questions. People don't have a good sense of how things come to look the way they do in the newspaper and on television. Very important kind of work, and I highly recommend this particular video to anyone who's working on that issue or working on media. Excuse me. So that kind of critique of media performance, again, very important, both aimed at journalists to try and affect the way that coverage plays out, as well as aimed at the public so they can start to read and critique. Because I think most of us continue to read the mainstream media. There is often a wealth of information available, in at least in the printed press, not so much in television these days. And it can be useful if one learns to understand it, critique it, to develop a framework in which one can read the mainstream media. Excuse me. Now I want to move on. That was in this framework I'm suggesting, in which we look at the need for structural reform, the need also to work with mainstream media, then the need to critique that same media. The fourth sort of leg of this media strategy I'm talking about is, of course, the development, support, and use of alternative media. Again, I think it's important to realize why alternative media is valuable, and it also has two functions. On the one hand, it does communicate directly to the public, and that's the importance of it. It can go around those filters that were just described in the video and reach the public directly. That's one of the crucial features, and it's, I think, why most people use alternative media. At the same time, alternative media also have an important function in that they push the mainstream often. That is, stories that would otherwise not be covered in the mainstream media often are forced into the news agenda by alternative media. I think one of the most dramatic examples of it was the fact that in 1983 and 84, Donald Rumsfeld, current Secretary of Defense, acting as an envoy of Ronald Reagan, our recently deceased president, who, if you read the media coverage, you might want to call him Saint Ronald after all of that. When Rumsfeld in 83 and 84 went as an envoy of Reagan's to Baghdad and met with Saddam Hussein and helped smooth over a number of diplomatic problems, that story never made it into the mainstream until it was broken in the alternative press and pushed quite a bit in the alternative press. So Jeremy Scahill, a very good reporter who's off and on been a producer for Democracy Now!, I remember reading that story first on the Common Dreams website, an alternative site for news and opinion. And I think the constant visibility of that story in the alternative press really did force it into the mainstream, and eventually it did make it into the Washington Post, the New York Times, and that famous still photograph from video of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein finally did make it. And that's not trivial. It's not just, you know, embarrassing to Donald Rumsfeld. It was a way to raise the issue of what was the relationship of the United States to Iraq throughout the 1980s. So alternative media, it's important to remember, have a function not only going directly to people and communicating news and ideas that would otherwise not be heard, but it also can have that effect of pressuring mainstream journalists, which can have a wider effect as well. And I think that's important to keep in mind. Whenever I talk about alternative media, I always say support of and use of the alternative media, because we should remember that none of these operations can be produced for free. I think too often, especially with web-based things, because it's so easy to use the web without paying, we forget that if we want journalism, alternative journalism, to prosper, it has to be funded. Because alternative journalism is more than simply people stating their ideas. Alternative journalism is journalism when it's done properly. That means it takes time and energy and resources. If you want somebody to investigate complex stories about U.S. foreign policy or, you know, the structure of current tax system, well, that takes time. And it takes training and expertise. You have to pay people. So it's very important to fund, I think, alternative media as well. The clip I bought from this other MEF video, I think, is a kind of alternative media. This is the most recent Media Education Foundation video. In fact, it's probably just being duplicated as we speak. It's called Hijacking Catastrophe, and it's a look at the Bush administration's foreign policy and the rise of the so-called neoconservatives within that administration. And as I said, the Media Education Foundation usually does work on the media specifically, but this is, in a sense, MEF branching out to do its own kind of alternative journalism. And this is, you know, very much intended to be out during this election season to give people a different way of understanding the Bush administration, the war in Iraq, and in fact the whole post-9/11 policy of the Bush administration. So what I'll do now is play a clip of this, then we'll come back and do some discussion.
Previous empires and its longevity and its permanence, which for all their
Morgan College and all their wide reading is an insane program. What does it have to do with the Constitution? What does it have to do with democracy? What does it have to do with the pursuit of happiness? Nothing. It's about power. It's about domination. It's about control of dwindling resources. I understand that they want the American public to believe that the invasion of Iraq was the response to September 11th. I think it is a lie. I believe that it is part of a neoconservative agenda to assert that American hegemony is untouchable. And September 11th gave them the opportunity to put in play plans that they had been considering since the first Bush administration.
In all of its previous incarnations, and long before 9/11 and the current war on terror, the Wolfowitz Doctrine had identified regime change in Iraq as a crucial first step toward global domination by force. In a widely circulated letter to President Bill Clinton in 1998, the members of the Project for the New American Century challenged the president to act forcefully and militarily to remove Saddam Hussein from power. 2 years later, George W. Bush would handpick many of these same neoconservatives for key foreign policy posts in the Pentagon and State Department. Once installed in government positions, as recent interviews with a number of former members of the Bush administration have revealed, the group maintained its long-standing focus on Iraq, a focus that intensified after the attacks of September 11th.
In the meetings at the Inner Sanctum of the Bush administration, the attack on Iraq was brought up from almost the first days, even though there was no evidence whatever that the Iraqis had been involved in this.
The president dragged me into a room with a couple of other people, shut the door, and said, "I want you to find whether Iraq did this." That George Bush wanted me to come back with a report that said, "Iraq did this."
From the very beginning, there was a conviction that Saddam Hussein was a bad person and that he needed to go.
Just 5 hours after American Airlines Flight 77 struck the Pentagon, and without any evidence linking Saddam Hussein to the attacks of 9/11, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was already ordering his aides to draw up plans for striking Iraq. The notes quote Rumsfeld as saying he wanted best info fast, judge whether good enough, SH, meaning Saddam Hussein. Go massive, Rumsfeld continued in the notes. Sweep it all up, things related and not.
The problem for the Bush administration is that plans that already existed for regime change in Iraq had to be justified. They couldn't just go in without public support. The public support was created by connecting Saddam Hussein to those fears of terrorism. The fear generated by 9/11, the fear of terrorist networks, has to be transferred to Iraq. That is, the American people have to learn to be as afraid of Saddam Hussein as they are of Osama bin Laden.
Soon after September 11th, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld set up a small intelligence office in the Pentagon, the Office of Special Plans, to create the rationales for the already planned attack on Iraq, to convince people that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and that he was linked to Al-Qaeda and 9/11. Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski worked in the Pentagon's Near East and South Asia office. She witnessed how the Office of Special Plans issued talking points about Iraq for senior government officials, allegedly based on intelligence.
The information in there, drawn from fact, you could find bits and pieces of fact throughout, but framed, articulated, crafted to convince someone of what? Well, of things that weren't true, things that weren't true. 911, Al-Qaeda related to Saddam Hussein, possibly some involvement there.
The liberation of Iraq is a crucial advance in the campaign against terror. We've removed an ally of Al-Qaeda.
The very things that a year later, President Bush himself denies and feigns his surprise. I don't know why everybody thinks that.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
Well, I worked in a place where they concentrated on preparing this storyline. and selling it to everyone that they can possibly sell it to.
It wasn't a failure of intelligence, it was the manipulation of intelligence to achieve a political goal. They were disciplined, they stayed on message, they marshaled all of their forces in this relentless public relations campaign to convince the American people that there was a threat from Iraq.
It's day four of the Bush team's full court press, giving speech after speech after speech, and issuing reports.
The United States knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Any country on the face of the earth with an active intelligence program knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
The choice is his. And if he does not disarm, the United States of America will lead a coalition and disarm him in the name of peace.
Out of the president's mouth, vice president's mouth, the same things that were being given to us to put into our superiors, our senior civilian leadership's mouths, these things were not based on intelligence that we saw, that everyone saw. They were based on a very selective reading of the intelligence and then a creative packaging such that you could push through these two big points that the president and the vice president and the whole neoconservative community used to justify this preemptive war on Iraq.
Less than a teaspoonful of dry anthrax in an envelope shut down the United States Senate in the fall of 2001.
Their policy depends on deception and secrecy, like every imperial policy in history. Even dictatorships have taken great efforts always to disguise what they're doing and why they're doing it to their own people.
This was never about weapons. This has always been about getting Saddam Hussein, and even in the most recent spin-up of this whole weapons issue, the Bush administration knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and yet they continued to use the inspection process as a vehicle to achieve the ultimate goal and objective of regime change.
These guys should be brought up in charges. There should be an investigation about whether these guys should be allowed to serve our country anymore. Because to me, it's criminal to say we're going to send our troops to war based on falsified intelligence, based on puffed up, exaggerated details.
So successful was the propaganda campaign that by 2003, polls were showing that the vast majority of Americans believed the unfounded claims that Saddam Hussein was linked to 9/11. And that he possessed stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. Beliefs that allowed the administration to frame an invasion of Iraq as a non-aggressive, justified act of self-defense under international law, rather than an offensive action designed to extend U.S. empire.
Contrary to the lies told to the American people, Iraq had absolutely no connections with 9/11. Al-Qaeda was despised by the regime in Iraq, which was a secular regime, not interested in religion as such. But they still wanted to go for it. And so they delayed it. They went into Afghanistan first, and then they decided to go for Iraq. Now, why did they decide to go for Iraq? That's the interesting question.
This is another video I'm going to highly recommend. Hijacking Catastrophe, this is just, again, one segment of it, will be out and available. In this case, it was produced by Jeremy Erpin, Sut Jolly from the Media Education Foundation. Both of these are available on a website, MEF.TV. The Media Education Foundation, for a long time, has sold most of its videos directly to schools and libraries at institutional prices, but because of the increased interest in this in the public and the number of community groups who are using these videos, they're now selling directly to the public. So MEF.TV, you can go to find this and several other videos. And I think Hijacking Catastrophe will be very important for people to see between now and the election. And I want to end just by pointing out why I think that video and, in a sense, alternative media more generally are so important. If you look at that whole video, much of what's in it you can find actually in the corporate commercial mainstream media. That is, the facts that are used in this video are available if you're a voracious reader and viewer. You can find all of the facts. The point is, and the value of this kind of work is, that it, in a sense, re-narrates those facts. It puts those facts together that are out there in these sort of random ways into a coherent story, which the mainstream media simply is not able or is unwilling to do. And I think we saw that in the clip we just looked at. For instance, if you, again, go back to this New York Times apology in their editorial note of last month about the weapons of mass destruction coverage, if you read that note carefully, it's actually, I think, is it would have been better if they'd never done it for the following reason. The New York Times says, our reporter, Judith Miller, who was unnamed in the note, she wrote a lot of stories about weapons of mass destruction based on what turned out to be inaccurate information. And we were sort of duped by that, they said, just like the Bush administration was duped by it. Now, what that does is set even further into the public mind that the Bush administration really did think there were weapons of mass destruction there, and they were conned by people like Ahmed Chalabi and these other, you know, exiles who were trying to manipulate them. So in a sense, even when the New York Times saw that it had consistently failed at its professional duty, that it reinforced a fundamentally fraudulent notion when they corrected themselves. And the correction itself didn't go very far. And in doing that, it was a gift to the Bush administration because it said, listen, the people in the Bush administration got manipulated too. When, of course, it was, as I think this points out, the manipulation of fraudulent intelligence data by the Bush administration to create this support for a war that the public otherwise would not have supported. And without alternative media to sort of make that point, I think that the public is really floating out there in this sort of sea of facts, some of them accurate, some of them distorted, but never with a framework to make sense of those facts. So again, this is an important component of a media strategy. Again, we want to look at structural change. We want to engage in the long-term political organizing of constituting a more democratic media. We want to at the same time work with the mainstream media because they are the game in town that reaches the most people. At the same time, as we also want to critique them to try and improve the information they distribute to people. And then finally, understanding that the mainstream media are never, in the current situation, going to be able to do that effectively. And therefore, the production of alternative media is so crucial. One final comment is simply, playing off hijacking catastrophe, is the importance of all of this at this particular moment in history. This is, I think, a really crucial time, not just because the war in Iraq has gone so badly and there's a need for serious political change, but I think as hijacking catastrophe goes on to talk about, we now live in a world in which there is no real debate about whether or not the United States is an empire. At one time, that was a contentious statement. I'm sure if we were here 3 or 4 years ago and said the US is an empire, you are easily dismissed as, you know, part of the loony left. My God, who could say such a thing? We're the world's oldest and most grand democracy. We don't build empires. But now, even on the right, it's acknowledged that the United States is in fact engaged in an imperial project of extending and deepening its control all around the world. There's an interesting Atlantic Monthly story about a year ago by Robert Kaplan called Supremacy by Stealth, in which he said, let's stop fussing about whether or not we're an empire. We obviously are. Let's go about the business of figuring out how to run the world better. So in a world in which, you know, big thinkers on the right are as willing to name the system that we live in an empire every bit as much as those of us who might be on the left, progressive, critical, dissident side, I think it's pretty clear what, for all of us, part of the political project has to be, which is, as I say in this book, Citizens of the Empire, trying to dismantle the empire from within. Because I think what we saw on 9/11 is a glimpse of what happens when empires fall from the outside. And I know of no sane person who wants that to be our future. So I think the political project of the moment very much is about that struggle to build movements that can derail the empire, that can dismantle the empire from within. And of course, one component of that is media, because the imperial project can only be sold to the public when these kind of propaganda campaigns are successful. So to me, this is the time for me politically, because I've spent my entire political life either involved in media or in the critique of US foreign policy. And I think those two things are very much central. Even if one's main interests are environmental or some sort of domestic politics, I think it's very important to understand that if this empire is not derailed and not dismantled, it will be very difficult to make progress on any front until this juggernaut is taken care of. So I think the task right now in any progressive political community is to try to make clear the importance of that project of dismantling the empire, and also articulate the importance of media work in that, which is why I think groups like Chicago Media Action are so crucial right now, because they can bring together a lot of these issues and focus attention where it is so desperately needed. So with that, I'll quit. Thank you for listening, and let's have some conversation.